Hello and welcome to Clear the Air with me, Jess.
And me, Kaylee. Let's Clear the Air with Jess and Kaylee will be available on all platforms where you listen to your podcast. The podcast is there to discuss all things personal, mindset, political, female, and a mass of food sharing. So make sure to tune in to us every Tuesday. Thanks, guys.
Hello.
Hello, everyone, and welcome. We're back, and welcome to our next episode of Let's Clear the Air, Kaylee and Jess. And today we have an awesome guest, and I'm going to introduce Carolyn Hobday, but I just want to say Carolyn has been so fantastic. And not only is she a really amazing author, but she also writes a monthly column for my company, House of Influence, and it's called The Self Steps. And each time I get a copy of this in before it goes online, I get so excited because I take so much away from your articles. And that's why we wanted to have you on, because it's just, you know, the light bulb moments you give to everyone from your articles, from your books, it's just fantastic. And that's what we're all about here. We really want to have people having as many light bulb moments as they can, because I think when we learn from experience of others, we can take so many things away and put it into our own lives and really start to change our lives around. So Carolyn, welcome.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, we were just speaking a moment ago before you hit record, and your new book has arrived.
It has, yes. It's so out exciting. On the 9th of June. So, yeah, very excited, yeah. So just having a bit of a teary moment after all the hard work.
Yeah, it's the most wonderful feeling. So your book so far, you know, one of my personal favourites was Redefining Selfish, because I think as women, we've really been taught that everyone has to be before us, and we forget what, you know, we're told being selfish is a bad thing. But actually, I think from personal experience as well, is that you need to be selfish at certain points, because it is not actually a bad thing. You can't give anyone else anything if you're not even looking after yourself. So tell us about that book first, because, you know, that helped me a lot, and I think it helps millions of others.
Yeah, it's... The thing with Redefining Selfish is that it absolutely came out of personal experience. It came out of that idea that I'd sort of suffered burnout, really. And a lot of that was about putting everybody else before me. And it's really the dip in the toe in the water book before you get into the new book that's just about to come out. So it's a way of just saying, look, I always use the analogy of when you go on a plane and they do the emergency procedure, they always tell you to put on your own mask and your own life vest before helping anyone else, even if those anyone else are your children, because that's how important it is. And I always say to people, if you are struggling for oxygen, if you are drowning, you are absolutely no use to anybody else. And I think particularly as women, I think we allow ourselves to drown in all the demands that are put upon us. I think particularly how hard we are on ourselves. And I think we're conditioned to be hard on ourselves. You know, I say at the start of the book that, you know, almost the biggest slight that we're worried about right from our school days is those girls in the schoolyard going, oh yeah, she really loves herself. Like it's a really bad thing to do. And actually, you know, what the hell is wrong with loving ourselves? So it's all about saying, let's be really practical about this. You know, it's not about, you know, changing the world. You know, it's about really small practical steps to just be a little bit more selfish and put ourselves first, because only then, only when we're in our best state, can we help anybody else.
Yeah, and I really find throughout my life I was such a people pleaser. Like we've talked about this, haven't we, Kaylee? We were always people pleasing. And then by the end of it, we're so burnt out. We've got nothing to give, not just to ourselves, to anyone else. And we wonder why depression rates are going through the roof, anxiety rates are going through the roof. And I think it's because we've been so conditioned. Like you said at school, I remember people saying to me, oh, she loves herself. And so straight away, I've got to do everything I can to take that away and hate myself. And then suddenly we're in this big pandemic of so many people hating themselves, and it's crazy.
Yeah, and I think social media is just so hard for that stuff, you know. And Jess, I'm sure, you know, you'll understand that, you know, better than anybody, is that, you know, people just want to seem to tear people down, or at least we're led to believe that people want to tear people down. I think this is the other thing, is that sometimes actually I'm not sure if people really do want to tear other people down necessarily. I think there's a small minority that, you know, because of their own self-loathing, want to do that. But I think, again, particularly as women, we're almost sort of encouraged to tear each other down, like to hate each other,
and
to sort of say bad things about each other. And in actual fact, a lot of the women that I meet and I talk to are just lovely, fantastic people who want nothing other than good stuff for other people, particularly other women. But I think there's almost like this idea that we're all sort of in some kind of bitchy dogfight all the time. And I don't think we are. And I don't know. I think that for me, I think that it goes back hundreds of years, you know, probably millennia, in fact, in terms of, you know, our fight for a role, sort of a belonging to the tribe and a role in the group. And, you know, as women, I guess, kind of like, you know, sex sells, doesn't it? You know, even back in those days, is that actually if you want to be nearest to the alpha male who runs the tribe, who's nearest to the source of food and power and all of those other things, we basically had to step over each other as women to be the chosen one for that man. And I just think there's a bit of that that's almost perpetuated in our psyche of, you know, doing each other down so that we can be, you know, the top dog, or dare I say it, the top bitch, you know, is kind of the thing. And I just think that it's all a bit tiresome, isn't it? Because I actually don't think that we really want to do that to each other.
No. Can I jump in? Because obviously, Jess and Carolyn, you know each other a little bit more. So obviously, I've been manically researching you and kind of trying to find out as much as I can about you. And one of the things that me and Jess talk about so much is kind of that expectation that you hit 18, you're meant to know kind of life and you're meant to know everything and be on your own development and know what's going on. And what I found so interesting when I was, you know, looking into you so much was kind of how, if I'd have looked at you from the outside into up to 2018, you know, you had your life, you had like the job, the relationship, you were all set. And then like you've described, you had that kind of go from you, you know, that job, that security in your personal relationship. And I'm so interested to ask you and know what then led you into the journey into your books, but also how now you carry that on. Because, you know, sometimes we all have that where we go, right, I'm going to start doing this. This is my steps. I'm going to write a journal. This is how I'm going to see. How do you carry that through? And I find that sometimes I can get lost in that path. And I find it so interesting, A, how incredibly you've done. And you know, I think you're incredible. But just I'd love to hear from you that start of that journey and how you like kind of carry on with that.
Yeah, thank you. So, yeah, in 2018, like, prior to that, like you say, Kaylee, I looked like I had everything. But I think that's the really important point. I looked like I had everything. So I had a big house, I had three cars on the drive, I had, you know, a really high powered job. You know, I was a board director I've been a board director in a couple of companies. And yeah, I looked like I had everything. I had the relationship, the ready made family, all the rest of it. And within the space of 10 days, the whole thing disappeared because I got pushed out of a job I loved because my boss was a bully and I stood up to him. And, you know, then my partner walked into the room, sort of, I think it was on day 10, which happened to be Friday the 13th of July 2018, and said, this relationship's over and you won't see the kids again and you need to leave the house. And yeah, my whole world caved in because he'd found my replacement. He'd asked her to marry him. And so, yeah, everything went. And I got to the point of suicide. And I'm really honest about that in the book. Mm-hmm. You know, I got to the point of suicide. I couldn't see any point of me being here anymore, not least because I couldn't have my own children. So I felt like my existence on the earth was just a waste of time. And I talk about that because I think it's really important to be honest about just how dark and how bad that got. Mm-hmm. And the journey out from there was messy. I think that's the first thing I'd say, is that it was really messy. And the whole point of the next book, which is Detwat Your Life, is really just charting what I learned. So the 12 steps in that book are really just a how-to guide of how to work out who you are, because that's the really important thing. Let me start with who I am, because I totally lost sight of that. I'd sacrificed my own identity to everything that everybody else needed. My job was my identity, my home, my relationship, all of that was about who I was. And I'd lost sight of actually who I really was in amongst all of that. So that was sort of the first bit. And that's the first part of the book. Now, the really important thing is that I went through all of that and all of that mess so that now I can come back in hindsight and go, here's the 12 steps that you need to go through. Not because those steps landed perfectly for me, but the point of writing about them, and it's a, you know, the subtitle of the book is Simple Steps to Being Unapologetically Yourself. Because those steps didn't fall perfectly for me. But if I can stop somebody else from going through all that mess whilst they're going through it, and kind of go, here's the how-to guide and you follow this. But it was really about understanding who I was and really reconnecting with that. Then it was about saying, okay, so what do I want my life to stand for? Because I think that's a question we don't always ask ourselves, you know, and one of the exercises that I get people to do in the book is actually to write their eulogy. Because I think if we write down what we want to be said about us at the end of our life, then we can start to work towards that and go, what are the things that I need to do? Who do I need to show up as in order to achieve that eulogy that I would like to be read out about me? And I even get people to look as far as, who would be listening to it? Who do you want to be present that would be listening to that eulogy because they'd mattered in your life and you'd mattered in theirs? And who would you want to be reading it out? Because again, I think we need to think about these things and say, well, who would that special person be for me? You might not know them right now, but what kind of person would you want to be reading it out? So it's really about saying, where do I want to go to? What do I want my life to stand for? And then there's a whole section in there that's the third stage of four, which is about love, which is all about how do I take care of myself and who do I want to have around me? Because I think that's a really important thing, particularly when we talk about toxic relationships, which I touch on in Redefining Selfish. Who is it that I want to have around? You know, how do I want that to feel? What impact do I want to have on others? And also, what impact do I want them and what am I going to allow them to have on me? So I talk about boundaries. I talk about trust, particularly self-trust. And then the last stage of it is about fulfillment, because it's about saying, OK, what is it that I really want to get? How do I go after this? That's when you get into actions. But I think in answering your question, I think it was a very messy process. But the first thing I had to do, was understand me and who I was, but also to start to value me. Because I had spent four decades, which probably for the both two of you seems like a really, really long time.
But, not that far from me.
So much younger. But I'd spent four decades really not liking myself. And my best friend used to say, I need you to learn to love yourself. And I just didn't even know what that meant. That I think that was the really important thing, is understanding my own value. And understanding that value to others that I had, that, like I said, in that moment of suicide, I thought I was worthless, totally worthless.
Yeah. I think so many, like for me, for certain, the idea of finding out who you are, which you just spoke about, that was life-changing for me, because my story was about a lot of childhood trauma, domestic violence, and lots of other things that had gone on. And when I grew up, and I'm supposed to be an adult now, I'm 18 and I've got to go into the world, the person I was a person who was in survival mode and then just trying to figure out that. So I never knew who I was without trauma. So until I actually touched that, and I would never let that, you know, I could talk about it as if it was, I was talking about the weather in Tesco's. It wouldn't bother me, but it's because I wouldn't allow them walls to ever get close. And it wasn't until I had my divorce that it was almost like the world had shattered inside and it pulled up everything. And I went to nearly suicide. You know, it was a pretty bleak time, but I'm so glad it happened, because what it did is it gave me that step to say, I don't want to be like this anymore. And I don't, there's something wrong and I'm not looking in the right places for it. So it allowed me that like opening to find it. And I had to learn who I was without trauma, but I had to heal that trauma before I could figure that out. And it was all these little things that, you know, that pop up that I, you know, spent years now, 4 years finding each different layer. And I know for the rest of my life, I'll be finding different layers of different things. And it was just the most, so when you said, you know, finding out who you are again, I didn't know who I was. I had no clue, because all I knew was from the age of like 7 or 8 was domestic violence. And then from then on, it was just thing after thing, and it was trauma based. So I was growing into trauma and understanding that, but I was never understanding who I was. So I couldn't be selfish, because I wanted to make sure everyone else was okay. And if I did try to be, I'd make some drastically awful decision, like a tornado had gone through my life. And I can never figure out why this wasn't getting fixed. And it wasn't until, like I said, 4 years ago, and I had it, you know, the rock bottom, I call it. And in my book, I wrote, you know, when you hit rock bottom, it sounds like a bad thing, but it was the best thing that ever happened to me, because that's when I had to go up.
Yes. Yeah. There is only, you know, only that choice. And I completely identify with what you're saying. And you know, and having read your book, Jess, you know, I get it. You know, like, you know, your trauma was very different to my trauma. But I think when you've been through that kind of stuff, I absolutely think one of the questions I had to ask myself was, am I perpetuating this trauma? Because is it almost where I feel most comfortable?
Yeah.
And I think you've been through a lot of trauma. You have to ask yourself that. You have to understand is that, because like you say, that survival mode is all that you know, then you create situations where you're constantly in that survival mode, because it's almost the only place you feel comfortable.
Yeah.
Even though it's really uncomfortable, but it's like, I know this. I know that I know who I am when I'm in that place of trauma. I understand it. So I'm going to keep myself in that place of trauma. And I talk about that in the first book. You know, when I talk about all the twats I met along the way, I absolutely was one of those twats. You know, I was a twat to myself. Sometimes, you know, sadly to other people because of that. But I absolutely think, you know, I had to, one of the things I had to reassess was, what responsibility do I have to take for changing this? Because yes, there were people that came into my life who could only be responsible for their behavior and the things that they did to me. And some of those things were really awful. However, my responsibility sat with, I let them in and I let them stay. And even when they did some terrible things, I put up with it. And that was my responsibility. And so for me, one of the things I've never, ever wanted to seem in any of my writing or when I talk about stuff is a victim, you know. And I think it's the thing that you do in your book, Jess, really well, is you do not sound like a victim. And I think that's really important. I think that comes from a huge place of strength, because we can all, you know, sit there and go, oh, woe is me, and it was all like really terrible. But actually, it is about how you pick yourself up from the bad stuff that happens, even if you're responsible for it.
Yeah.
And move forward.
Yeah. And I think for a long time, I've talked to you about this, Kaylee, that I sat in victim mode for a very long time. And it wasn't until I flipped out of that, and I'm writing a book at the moment, my first or second chapter is victim mode, it's called, because I'm enabling myself. I call the victim mode an enabler. And anyone else that comes around, like my nan or my mum, would be like, oh, but you've been through a lot. It's okay. If you want to go out with your friends, go out. And like, they mean well, but it's actually victim mode enabling, because then I'm like, oh yeah, I've had it tough, so I best do this. Or oh, I've made this bad decision again, but I've had it tough. And it was just constantly enabling it. And I was like, this isn't working. Like, this really isn't working. It wasn't until I thought, okay, it's almost like I had to take responsibility for my life. And when you take responsibility, you can't be in victim mode, because you've got to fix it.
Yeah. And I think at first, when you kind of go through that anger, you are left with so much anger that can trigger that kind of victim mode as well, because the anger that actually... it takes a lot of strength to not go into victim mode. But at the same time, when you go through that, or you revisit memories, or you're going through that, whether it's in therapy, that anger does bubble up, because you're like, I was put through that. And all the, you know, we're all put through things, and we all go through trauma within our lives. But at the same time, it is going through that anger and getting through that to figure out how to not feel like you're in victim mode, because you are at first, you know. And that sometimes when you feel that trigger, Jess, you were talking about it then, you know, when you're figuring out the layers of throughout your life, you will, in terms of how you deal with things, you know, emotionally and things like that, is, you know, when you feel that, you know, it touches on something, whether it's in a relationship or a situation, and it feels uncomfortable, and whether it's anger or sadness, it's getting through that and therefore not deviating yourself to victim mode. I think it's so interesting what you're saying.
Yeah. And I think you're absolutely spot on, Kaylee, because I do think, you know, it's okay to feel sorry for yourself for a bit. Mm. It's okay to every now and again feel sorry for yourself. You know, that is all right, you know, because I have a real problem with the concept of resilience, you know, because I think sometimes with resilience, it's sort of like, you know, it's like, well, it doesn't matter what people throw at us. Let's just make ourselves more resilient. And it's like, no, let's not do that. Mm. You know, let's try and stop these things from happening in the first place, or you know, let's find better ways. You know, just always telling people they just need to be stronger isn't helpful. But I think you're absolutely right. And the way I always describe it now, because a lot from my childhood is that I was always told I was too sensitive. You're too sensitive. Yeah. and now I see that as my superpower, because I see my emotions like a piano keyboard, and I can play up and down the whole range of those emotions now because I understand them. I can identify them. And I actually think it's a real superpower to be able to play across all of them, or at least to recognize all of them, recognize them. Like you say, Kaylee, when, you know, there's a bit of a trigger and you feel a bit sad, or you feel a bit angry, that's okay. Because as long as you can sort of look at that keyboard and think, oh yeah, I know which note that is. I know which note is that. And I know actually what it is that's made me play that note. But even with happiness, because again, I have a real issue with, like, you know, this idea that we all trying to, you know, be happy. Happiness is really, you know, it's a really sort of ethereal concept, and it comes and goes. I'm much more of a fan of positivity, because positivity is a much more consistent state, because actually it's about being positive through the bad stuff, and knowing that there'll be other better days ahead than happiness, which is kind of this, I constantly need to be joyful. And I think happiness is just one key on the piano keyboard. And if you play just one note on a piano keyboard all the time, it's just it's not a tune, is it? It's, you know, ding, 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 you know, that's all it is. And that's what happiness is. If you played that note all the time, you'd get very, very bored. So the idea that we have all of these emotions, it's this entire keyboard of things that we can, you know, play or just identify, then I think it's okay. It makes it okay to go, actually, it's all right for me to have all of these emotions and to feel all of them at various times. I just need to decide which notes that I want to, you know, play more often than others, and which notes I don't want to just keep bashing out all of the time.
I think, you know, happiness is that is what you just said there has really resonated, because it was when I was in the depth of despair, it was always like, why aren't I happy? Why can't I be happy? And it took me doing all that work to realize it's not about being happy. It's about figuring out how to ride the wave. And I spoke about that, didn't we, Kaylee, on another podcast about riding the wave. I would either be on top of the world or I'd be in the depth of despair. I couldn't ever find a middle ground, and my happiness was so up that it would shoot back down really, really fast. And I think the way that I've been my happiest is knowing that even in the hard times, just how to manage which emotion it is. So I completely understand the keyboard theory. It's like I can figure out and accept that emotion at that time and say, okay, for instance, dad's got cancer, he's in a hospice. That's a hard thing to deal with. And old me would have gone into absolute mental breakdown and gone off to drinking and making stupid decisions, probably dating someone that's a complete arsehole just to cover up what the initial problem was. But now it's like, okay, I'm going to allow myself to feel a different emotion. I don't just have to be happy or sad. It was like, that was my only go-tos. I didn't know anything else. Whereas now I can say, okay, this is a challenging time. This feels a certain way. I'm going to feel it and I'm going to process that emotion. And what I found is by processing emotions, I am happier. And it doesn't mean I constantly have to be walking around with a smile on my face, hopping down the street, but it means that I can handle what's coming my way.
And that's the point of positivity. You know, it's that sense of contentment that even if things are a bit rubbish today, or even just this hour, or right in this 5 minutes, I actually know and I have the tools and the ability to handle it. And like you say, it's like ride the wave, you know, whatever the analogy is that you want to use. It's knowing that you have that foundation of, I know I can get out the other side of this, whether it's good or it's bad. Because again, you know, the good stuff, again, doesn't last, does it? You know, we're not perpetually in a good place. We're also not perpetually in a bad one. And one of my favorite sayings is like, this too will pass. Yeah, you know, whether it's good or bad, but this too will pass.
I literally and say that, I love it. Yeah. I love that phrase so much.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's so good. I want to, I just would like to find out, because I think it's amazing. I think it's when you go through a journey like that, it's incredible for you. But I think to then go and to write it down in the way that you have and to do what you've done is amazing for so many people. And I'd love to know more about kind of the day, you know, in which you decided to start writing your first book and what kind of how you led yourself into to going into becoming an author.
Yeah, it was never part of my plan. I mean, I think if you'd ever said to me, like, I'd become an author, I'd be like, no. I mean, I've always loved to write. You know, my first degree was in English and creative studies. So I've always enjoyed writing. I would say that I'm pretty accomplished at it. But did I ever think I'd write a book? No. You know, what was really interesting is that after the world crashed in for me, I spent 9 months in therapy, which versus earlier on in my life, because I'd spent a bit of time in therapy like 20, 25 years before that. And it was an awful experience, I have to say. So it was a big deal for me to go and speak to somebody and unpack what happened. And it was kind of through that. And I mentioned that in the acknowledgements in my first book, but because I just very much like you described, Jess, I would just be, oh yeah, that's happened to me. And I'd start off and I was sitting in therapy and I would talk about things that had happened in my life. And I would just completely brush them off and go, oh, yeah, well, this happened. And then that happened. And it was my therapist that would go, whoa, 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 whoa. Let's just go back a step. Let's go back to this. Cause that's really something. And that's really significant. But I would just be glossing over it and going, yeah, this is the story of my life and it's all fine. And, you know, and I couldn't have kids and I went through the menopause at 19 and I was raped and I was, you know, and all this stuff that I was like trotting out as if it was, this is just my story. And as if it had happened to somebody else entirely. Yeah. And it was sitting in that therapy and kind of, you know, unpacking that. But I think it was more the fact I had the most amazing therapist. She was a wonderful woman. And there were a few times when I was telling her my story and we were unpacking it, where she was kind of like open mouthed. And she was like, and then what happened? And I think it was that actually that I thought, here I am, I'm sitting in front of a clinical psychologist. So, you know, she's really, really knows her stuff. She'll have seen a lot. She'll have heard a load. And there were times when she was like, and, you know, and then that happened to you. And I think that was the moment when I realized that maybe I had a story worth telling, that actually there was a lot of content in there. And I think it started to ignite kind of this passion, this real fire in my belly about, if I could just take this and just translate for one more person and just help them to understand what's happened to them or find a better route through it, then actually something really good has come out of a lot of stuff that was really bad. And I think it was that. And so it was sort of sitting in that therapy and I thought, maybe I should write this down. I mean, for years, my friends had sort of been going, oh my God, you should like write a book about your life, or, you know, and they used to joke about who would play them in the movie of my life. You know, we used to get into that discussion for a bit of a laugh. And then I thought, you know what, maybe there's something in it. And I just thought, I'm going to start writing this down. I'm going to start just and seeing what comes out when I start to write it down. Because I think, again, a lot of people kind of imagine that they might write a book, but actually, a journey of 1,000 miles starts at the first step, doesn't it? And so I just thought, I was going to start writing it down. I think when I did that, it just, and I wrote it chronologically. I just thought, right, I'm just going to go from the start and I'm going to write it chronologically. And I don't know whether you felt the same thing, Jess, but it just starts to tumble out. And yeah. Actually,
it's like a therapy on its own, isn't it?
Yeah. And you find the words. And I would sit, and I found the only way I could write about it and write about it authentically was absolutely to take myself to the moment, into those emotions, and then write what came out. And so there would be times when I would be laughing my head off, quite often texting my best friend going, oh my God, can you remember when? or I'd be sobbing. And it was the only way to really sort of get the emotion and find the right words to describe the emotions, whatever those happen to be. And it just, I don't know, it just grew legs and started running around, I guess, after that. It was like, okay. And I started off thinking I'd write a book. I'd write the background to me so that then I could start talking about the stuff I wanted to talk about. And it was only when I started writing it down that actually it turned into two books, because I thought, actually, there's a lot of work history and some of it went in the first book, but there was an awful lot of it. There was just too much of it. So that's when I thought, oh, it's going to be a book about sort of me and my life in the background, and then probably a book about my corporate career, because I worked for some huge organizations. And so it turned into two books. But then I realized that actually the first book could only really take people as part up to the point of the implosion. Mm-hmm. And that's when Detwat Your Life, which is the second book of the trilogy that's about to come out, because I thought, actually, I then need to tell people about what happened on that journey out. You know, this is everything that went before and everything I learned, but then I need to tell people about, okay, how did I pull myself out from that dark place? What was that journey like? And that's really where the second book came
it's
from.
It's incredible. It's absolutely incredible. So tell everyone what date it's out, where they can find it, the name of your book, because we all, well, it's the second part. So everyone, can you please say the first one for anyone who's not read your books before as well?
Yeah. So so overall, it's called it's the Twats Trilogy. So the first book.
Best name ever.
The first book is my memoir, and that's called All the Twats I Met Along the Way. So you can get that on Amazon and other online retailers. You could also buy a copy from my website, so at carolynhobday.com. So the second book of the trilogy is out on the 9th of June, and that's called Detwat Your Life. So that's simple steps to being unapologetically yourself. So it's my 12 self steps, and is really just designed people to assess where they are in their life and assess where they want to get to and work out the bits in between of how they're going to get there. The third book of the trilogy, I haven't started yet. Well, I've written some of it, but that's going to be called Twats at Work. So that's going to be all about my huge HR career in some big corporates and the fact that I discovered that common sense isn't all that common. When you're with lots of people. So that will be the third book of the trilogy. But the one in between, the first and the second of the trilogy, was Redefining Selfish, No Guilt, No Regrets. So all of them have been available on Amazon or via my website.
That's amazing. And I just want to say a big, big thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I'm really so excited for your third book as well. I can't wait to pick your brain on that. Because workplace is just another minefield, I think, for mental health in corporate, and just generally workplaces have such a big influence on life. So I definitely would love to speak to you more about that. But for me, thank you so much for coming on. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
And you'd be able to, you know, just unpacking your brain sometimes and hearing you talk, we know it's going to help so many people. So again, a massive thank you from both of us for coming on to the podcast.
Yes.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
Thanks to all our listeners, and we will see you next week.
We'd like to say a special thank you to Audio Boom for distributing the series, and Popple for our jingle and raspberry.